It's 5:06. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we'll talk to a political scientist about documents related to the John Doe investigation. They were accidentally released on Friday. Some critics say these documents show a secret fundraising operation involving the governor.
As you hit the road today on your way home from work, you might lament the number of potholes or crumbling pavement you encounter along the way. While the cost of maintaining our roads and highways can seem steep, some reports suggest that the cost of not maintaining them is much higher.
Our next guest says when you look into the collateral economic damage that comes with driving over deteriorating highways, it adds up and ultimately takes a toll on our economy.
Andy Herman is with us now. He's the past president of the American Society of Civil Engineers. Andy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Let's start out by talking about how much funding currently goes into maintaining our U.S. highways. Do you know the number?
Right now, I think we're spending about $70 billion a year for the highways and about $12 billion for our bridges. And that's annually per year.
And is it enough? How much do we actually need?
Well, the Federal Highway Administration has done an estimate of what we really need. And for the bridges, we need over $20 billion. So we're only investing about 20.5, so we're about $8 billion short just for the bridges. And with the highways, I believe it's over $100 billion. We're only spending about $70 billion. So you can see we're not spending enough each year for our bridges and our roads.
And what, I guess, how does that add up in terms of collateral damage that we were just talking about in our intro there? What's happening to as a result of the lack of necessary funds?
Well, we can do it both on a national basis and also on a Wisconsin basis. Just looking at our roads, driving on roads in need of repair costs Wisconsin motorists over $1 billion a year in extra vehicle repairs and operating costs. You can break that down. It's about $281 per motorist. But if you want to look at it on a national level, the American Society of Civil Engineers put out a Failure to Act economic series. It's a report on what happens if we just keep investing in our infrastructure at the same as we've been doing for the last 5 or 10 years. What happens to the U.S.? And we found out that not increasing our investment, just keeping the investment the same as it is, will cost the American economy more than 877,000 jobs. It's going to suppress the growth of our gross domestic product by almost $900 billion by the year 2020. It's actually going to hit each family's budget for over $1,000 per year between now and 2020 for additional travel costs and additional maintenance costs. It'll increase transportation costs for businesses by $430 billion between now and 2020. So guess what? We're paying even though we're not getting the benefit of improving our infrastructure.
And your organization estimated that congestion on major urban highways even costs the economy more than $100 billion a year in fuel and lost work time. Talk about how you arrived at that number. Why is it so high?
Well, you start looking at the amount of time people sit in traffic, and you look at the value of their time being wasted, but you also look at the amount of fuel they're losing, wasting. And you can even go into the environmental. Look at the additional carbon monoxide that's being pumped into the air. Delays. In terms of getting goods to market or the raw materials to the factories. It all adds into delays, additional costs to Americans.
How do our roads, our highways, our bridges rank in terms of acceptable quality today? Are we generally driving on safe infrastructure or not?
Well, if you look at the statistics put out by the federal government, 11% of our bridges are considered structurally deficient, and another 14% are considered functionally obsolete. Now, in Wisconsin, it's a little bit better, though not good. The number's a little bit smaller in terms of functionally obsolete and structurally deficient. It's only 8% structurally deficient and only 5.5% functionally obsolete. And these are things that affect our driving. Functionally obsolete bridges aren't safe, but they're designed to older codes. They may not have the same lane width. They may not have adequate turning radiuses. They may not have the capacity to carry modern trucks. Structurally deficient means there's something that could cause adverse effects in the structure itself. And for that reason, it's being watched. It may have a load posting for minimum loads or maximum loads that can go over it, or it may have emergency repairs, or it may actually be closed.
So you're saying, though, that it's, I don't know, is it okay to still drive over a bridge that's been called functionally obsolete? It doesn't sound good.
Or even structurally deficient.
Yes.
Well, in the country, every highway bridge in the nation is required by law to be inspected at least every 2 years. And when the DOT, Department of Transportation engineers, look at those bridges, if they find something wrong, they have several options. I mean, if it's really bad, they can close the bridge. They can post it for loads. They can reduce the speed limit going over the bridge. They can decrease the number of trucks. Or they can start looking at the defect more frequently. And a lot of times they do that. They watch it and monitor it.
How does Wisconsin rank for safety of roads and bridges?
Well, in terms of deficient bridges and functionally obsolete bridges, you actually have a lesser number than the national average. You only have about 5.5% versus 14% for functionally obsolete, and only about 7% versus the 11% for structurally deficient. So you're doing a little bit better on your deficient bridges.
But still deficient, all the same, it sounds like.
But still deficient. We should be cutting down on the number of these. We have to make investments in the infrastructure so that we can keep on using it. Right now, the average age of a bridge is over 42 years old. And when those bridges were designed, they were probably designed for a 50-year design life. So we have to do the maintenance. We have to do the repairs to keep them going, to extend their lives.
So it seems especially dangerous to let bridges go in disrepair. I'm wondering if, given a limited amount of funds and resources, should the priority go to repairing bridges first, or if forced to make a choice, what would you choose?
Well, we have to do that maintenance. We have to maintain the bridges because it actually pays off in the long run. Dollars in maintenance up front save you many dollars later down the road. But you have to do the repairs based on those inspections. You have to make sure the bridges are safe. So that's what the departments of transportation have, the hard decision. They have to look at the limited budgets they have and then apply it to the maintenance, which sometimes can be deferred, but also to keeping them safe by doing the repairs and rehabilitations they have to do.
We're talking about how crumbling roads and highways and bridges can have a deeper impact on the overall economy. Our guest is Andy Herman, past president of the American Society of Civil Engineers.
And we want to hear from you. If you had the unfortunate experience of maybe driving over a pothole, hearing something in your car break, blowing a tire, what was the cost of the damage to you? What are the roads like where you live or where you've driven on vacation maybe this summer? What should we do? How should we pay to improve those roads and bridges? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
We're learning how damaged roads, bridges, and highways can take a toll on the overall economy with Andy Herman. He's past president of the American Society of Civil Engineers.
And you can join the conversation. What are the roads like where you are? Should the United States, should Wisconsin invest more into maintaining better roads, highways, and bridges? Is there something else that can be done to reduce the economic impact that a crumbling transportation infrastructure might bring? And are you in the business one way or the other? Are you with the Department of Transportation, a road builder yourself, or a trucker? What do you see on the job? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Andy, we spoke earlier about some of these dollar figures and the impact of having congested highways and bridges in disrepair. Has the American Society of Civil Engineers, your organization, suggested solutions to the problem?
Well, there's a number of ways to make investments. It's basically up to our political leaders to choose some of those. Right now, if you go back to the beginning of the interstate highway system back in 1956, it was a pay-as-you-go. We had a gasoline tax or a user fee that was added to every gallon, and that helped us pay as we go to build the whole system. But if you start looking back, it was raised in the early years, but the last time it was raised was 1993. That's 20 years ago. So that federal tax, that 18.3 cents a gallon that goes to the Federal Highway Trust Fund, hasn't been raised in 20 years. So we're living on fees that are 20 years old, even though there's been inflation and cost of living rises in that period. So, you know, it's no wonder that the Highway Trust Fund keeps going to the brink of insolvency and why they have to do some short-term fixes from the general funds. We really should find ways to increase the user fee, and the gas tax would be a simple one, but it doesn't seem to be politically available right now.
How does mass transportation like commuter rail or other forms of public transportation factor into the discussion?
Those have funds that are similar to or part of the Highway Trust Fund. So there are certain percentages that go to mass transit. And if you think about it, it's logical, because if you start getting more people to take mass transit, you're taking more off the highway.
Let's take a call from Mary Jo in Milwaukee. Hi, Mary Jo.
Hello. I traveled quite a bit through Japan, and I noticed that their highways, their freeways, were perfect everywhere I went, and I didn't see construction going on either. So I just wonder if you know how they do it. Do they do more preventive maintenance, or were their roads built out of better materials to begin with? Do you know that?
I'm not sure exactly how Japan does it, but a lot of other countries charge a lot more on their gas tax. If you look at Europe, you're paying probably the equivalent of $6+ a gallon. So they're using more money to improve their and maintain their infrastructure. The U.S. isn't.
I wonder, too, how much the climate has to do with the health of our roads, too. At least here in Wisconsin, we can always expect potholes to pop up after the spring and after the winter has done its damage to our roads. And I don't know that the same would be true in Japan.
Well, the northern part of our country, particularly the Northeast, does have a severe climate, and we do put a lot of salt on our roadways and bridges. And that salt actually gets into the pavements, and there's reinforcing bars in the pavements, and as the salt and the water reaches it, those reinforcing bars start to rust. And when steel rusts, it expands up to 8 times its volume. That's why you have the pop-outs, which cause the potholes on the roads and the bridges.
Let's take a call next from Jerry in Ladysmith. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, I'm wondering if Andy could address the economics of asphalt surfaces versus concrete. You know, obviously the asphalt surface is a little cheaper on the front end, but I think the concrete lasts longer. I'm wondering if you can address that.
Yes, the concrete can be made, you know, with the thicknesses and the reinforcement, and the bases can be placed in, and it does cost more, but you're looking at a long-term investment. We really should be looking at life cycle costs between asphalt and concrete when we're actually doing the design or the planning, actually not even the design, the planning to try and get the best economic package to put into our roadways. And the other thing we have to think about is how much downtime is there for the traveling public while we're changing these. Maybe if we can get a roadway that lasts a little bit longer, we can inconvenience the public less.
1-800-642-1234 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation. 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Andy, we were talking about bridge health and infrastructure earlier, and I think back to the tragic events in Minneapolis a few years ago with the bridge simply collapsing. How are we on the brink of more of those? And if so, where should we be looking first?
Well, it's interesting. I-35 in Minneapolis was actually rated as structurally deficient, but they were rehabilitating it at the time. The study that went into why it actually failed came up with a design flaw. The gusset plates, the steel plates that hold the triangular members together, were actually, several of them were only half as thick as they should be. And that combined with the loads on the bridge for the construction materials being offset and the actual construction all contributed to that bridge going down. But it was a structurally deficient bridge, but it was being rehabilitated. It's lucky that across the country, we do have the federal requirement for the biennial bridge inspection, because that allows us to look at each bridge and to make sure that it is safe for the traveling public.
Bill in Greendale is on the line next. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Yeah, I was. I understand that the driving, we're driving less now, and I had a question. How do you think that'll? Will we need to get extra taxes then if we do go the gas tax in the gas? And then, do you think it's fair how much the truckers pay for the roads? Do you think they pay enough?
Well, I think the cost of diesel fuel is actually higher than the gas tax at this point. But you're very right. We've been pushing for better fuel efficiencies on our cars. We have hybrid cars going on now, so we're actually getting more miles out of each gallon. And that means we're buying less gasoline, and we're getting less of that 18.3 cents per gallon into the Federal Highway Trust Fund. There's been various studies and talks and actually tests for mileage-based fees, where you'd have similar to an Easy Pass device in your car that would basically you would pay by the mile rather than by the gallon. And these have been tested, I believe, in Minnesota and also in Oregon to see if they're viable, and they are viable. It's just a question of how do we want to pay for our infrastructure, and that's one of the ways. There's also additional fees or toll roads, tire taxes, but it all comes down to, you know, who should be paying for the roads? Shouldn't it be the users of the roads, the people who benefit from them?
Yeah, and what about that, too? As people start to maybe turn toward mass transit or carpooling, or I'm thinking of people in urban areas such as New York City, where the subway is very well heavily used, do those people have any responsibility in paying toward the health of the roads and other elements of infrastructure or not?
Well, mass transit is usually subsidized. Some of it comes from the gasoline tax. But it's funny you mentioned New York City area, because the tolls on the bridges for the Port Authority or the MTA, some of those tolls actually go back into mass transit. So it's usually the other way, trying to reduce the number of cars on the road by getting and enticing more people to take mass transit.
Let's take a call from Kent in Porterfield. Hi, Kent.
Hi, how are you doing? Okay, I live up here in Marin County in the township of Porterfield. And township of Porterfield and Marin County are separate from each other. I don't know why, but that's what they did years ago. Now, what we had in 2014, everybody in the township of Porterfield has had a huge, huge tax increase on our property tax alone from the Marin County tax. And the reason is because years ago, the people who ran a town of Porterfield never increased at all to take care of these roads. Marin County always took care of them. So now we're not in Marin County anymore, but we live there. Now the town of Porterfield has to take care of these roads. And the tax increase is just incredible to pay for these roads. Mm-hmm. Now we are suffering when everybody else uses our roads. We have people from Michigan, all over the place, coming and using our roads for shortcuts or semi-trucks, semi-trailers, logging trucks. This should be put on everybody, not just the township taxpayers.
Thanks, Kent. And here's a situation where it sounds like instead of paying through a gas tax, it's going out of property taxes. Andy?
Yes. I mean, that's another way of doing it. And that's one of the things we should all agree to, because roads and bridges, we're a nation. We may be buying vegetables that come from California and Wisconsin, or we may be buying steel that comes from another state in the country, but interstate commerce goes and supplies goods and services for everybody in the country. So, yes, they may be using our roads, but some of the trucks and other vehicles that are moving around through the other part of the country that give us the benefit, someone else may be paying for that, too, through a different means, maybe not a property tax, but maybe a local gas tax.
So other than the gas tax we've been talking about, what's the secret to a solvent transportation system?
Basically, a dedicated fund so that the investment can be made in new infrastructure or new roads and bridges, but also that the maintenance and the repairs and rehabilitations can be done. We need a dedicated funding source, and that's what the Highway Trust Fund was originally meant to be. But it's just fallen behind. due to inflation. The last time the federal one was raised, again, is back in 1993, 20 years ago. So we need some decisions to be made that we can share the costs among all the users of the roads and bridges across the country.
Andy, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
That was Andy Herman, past president of the American Society of Civil Engineers, telling us about how our crumbling roads, bridges, and highways may be affecting the overall economy. It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at Central Time, we'll hear how one Wisconsin town got together to write a novel.
First, some documents related to Wisconsin's John Doe investigation were mistakenly released on Friday afternoon. The documents show what critics are calling a secret fundraising operation involving Governor Scott Walker.
Here to join us about what's in the documents and what we can glean from them is Ken Mayer, professor of political science at UW-Madison. Ken, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so we see these documents out, at least for a little while this weekend, showing what appeared to be a secret fundraising operation or a previously undisclosed fundraising. What did we find out in these documents?
What they showed is that there was a significant effort on behalf of the governor and his people to raise money for the Club for Growth, which is the group at the center of the John Doe investigation, or this part of it. The issue, as far as the prosecutors are concerned, is that they are claiming that that effort constituted coordination, which would make those efforts and the spending of Club for Growth a campaign contribution. And so what they're arguing is that efforts to steer contributions through the Club for Growth by Walker constituted illegal coordination in an effort to circumvent contribution limits and disclosure.
And response has been predictably divided. Democrats saying this amounts to close to a smoking gun proving illegal coordination. Supporters of the governor saying this is free speech. The governor can suggest to people that they donate money wherever they want. It's not really coordination. How do we define coordination? How does this all fit into that concept?
The difficulty is that the definition of coordination is ambiguous. Mm-hmm. And so what we're in a gray area here, because it is true that elected officials, even people who are campaigning, are permitted to raise money for outside groups. The issue comes in when those expenditures or the efforts of those groups are coordinated with the campaign, which would make them a contribution to the campaign. The GAB, the Government Accountability Board, defines coordination as expenditures that are made upon the request by or in consultation with a candidate or a candidate's agents. But that's ambiguous, and it turns out that efforts to show coordination, it's very difficult to do that, because unless there is a completely explicit agreement between a campaign or a candidate and an outside group, you have to draw inferences. And in this case, there is an additional ambiguity, because the Club for Growth, the attorneys for the Club for Growth, are arguing that since they were making issue ads, that they weren't actually engaged in express advocacy, advocating clearly the election or defeat of the governor, that those don't count as campaign ads. And that would be a novel theory that would open the door to even more independent spending. And really, the crux of the issue is whether the involvement of the governor with the Club for Growth is sufficient to constitute a legal finding of coordination, and whether the activities of the Club for Growth, because they were, in their view, issue ads, whether it is even possible to have coordination with the group that is making those kinds of expenditures. And one of the things that should be clear from the fits and starts of this investigation and the controversy surrounding it is that the answers are not clear, at least from a legal standpoint.
So one thing from what you're saying, what is clear is that it's not illegal if the governor went to Donald Trump, I think, was one of the names on the list and said, hey, you ought to donate money to Club for Growth. If it stops there, that's completely legal?
Right, and that's correct. The issue then becomes, was there coordination between the governor's campaign and Club for Growth in terms of message? And the emails that were released are suggestive, but they are not conclusive. If they were, I think we would have already seen some results of the investigation. And obviously, the prosecutors are alleging one interpretation. The Club for Growth and the governor are insisting on another interpretation. But we are getting to the point where the specific legal question becomes less important than the political fallout, that we are a couple of months away from the election. There's going to be continued appeals and involvement before the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. And no matter what happens with the legal investigation, at this point, it presents certainly a headache for the Walker campaign, given how close the race now appears to be.
Well, let's follow up that point, that whether or not it's illegal, that whole appearance of impropriety, I guess, would be the issue. One of the things that came out in the papers this weekend, Gogebic Taconite donating $700,000 to the Club for Growth, not long before, I gather, a big piece of mining legislation reducing regulations for an iron mine in northern Wisconsin came through. Democrats are saying, hey, this is pay to play. You got a big donation, you get a law passed. Does it look that way, or is this something that the governor would have signed off on anyway, donation or no?
Well, the answer is that it's probably both are true. It certainly confirms what a lot of people insist is true about the political process. In fact, the Senate Minority Leader Chris Larson was flat out said this looks like outright bribery. And then the governor's people responds that he was not aware that the contribution was made, and it's not a surprise that a pro-business, pro-growth governor would have signed this legislation. And so we're back to the issue of it certainly doesn't look good, and it presents a political problem, because there's an old maxim in politics that when you're explaining, you're losing. And the news coverage in the last 3 or 4 days has been the governor and the governor's people and lawyers for Club for Growth explaining what was happening, that it's not a big deal and that doesn't constitute illegal or improper behavior. And that alone suggests that at least temporarily, that the dynamic of the campaign of the race has shifted to this, and that can't work in the governor's favor.
That said, while he is on the defensive a little bit now, come Election Day, is this something that's going to change the minds of the elusive undecided voter in this state?
That's very hard to say. The answer is probably it's possible. But the other issue is that there aren't that many undecided voters in the state, that Walker remains a highly polarizing figure. Most Republicans are extremely fond of him. Most Democrats are just as extremely they dislike him. And so if you're a Republican who's a supporter or a Democrat who's an opponent, you are going to interpret this through the lens of that support. Walker's people are arguing that this is a political vendetta by biased prosecutors, and Democrats will say, we told you all along. The issue comes that in a race that's very close, as this probably will be, it doesn't take a swing of 5 or 7 percentage points of the electorate to swing the election. It could come down to a relatively small number of people changing their mind, or additional Democrats coming out, or some marginal Republicans staying home. I think certainly all other things being equal, the governor would prefer not to have to deal with this at this point.
Back to the legal side of things, the John Doe investigation, John Doe 2, technically is on hold right now, thanks to an order from a judge, but there's a federal court that might bring it back into action. Do you have any idea? Do we have any idea when we might hear something about that? Is it going to be right before Election Day or right after?
Well, I've seen some reports. I haven't actually seen the schedule for the Seventh Circuit, but I think the Journal Sentinel reported that there is going to be an initial hearing next month in September. And I think it's very difficult to tell when the Seventh Circuit would actually issue his opinion. My guess is that I would seriously doubt that we would see an opinion one way or the other before the election, in part because if you're a federal judge, you are going to be cautious about making a decision, I think, in the heat of a campaign when you don't really have to, but that gets into deeper issues about the nature of judicial decision-making. But the fact that this hearing is going to happen in September, which is going to generate news coverage, all of that is going to keep this in the public eye during the campaign.
Turning to the bigger issue of money in politics, Republican State Senator Dale Schultz, whose own mining legislation was superseded by what actually passed, he said regarding this news, the quality of public policy making in Wisconsin has changed, he's arguing, since big money came to the state. Is that true? Has big money changed the way politics gets done here?
Well, that depends on what your view of the policies is. Certainly, it seems in the last decade or so that we've seen a significant increase in outside spending with independent groups coming in, and a lot of people will view that through the lens of the Republican sweep in 2010 and attribute that sweep to that outside money. And I think that's a little too simplistic. But at a time when people are already frequently disillusioned about the political process and feel that they don't have a voice, stories like this, when we're talking about hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars coming in from a single or small number of contributors, it certainly confirms the disillusionment that a lot of people feel about politics, even if it's more difficult to draw a direct link between those contributions and the outcomes. But that's a longer debate.
Ken, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Anytime.
That was Ken Mayer, professor of political science at UW-Madison.
Ask any author and they'll tell you, writing a novel is no easy feat. From conception to publication, there's a lot that goes into the process. But what happens when you replace one author with a community of writers?
That's what happened in Baraboo, Wisconsin. Residents there recently completed work on their second community-written novel. It's called Dr. Vertigo's Circus Spectacular. Each chapter of the book was written by a different author.
Kelly Dwyer joins us now. She's a senior lecturer of English and creative writing at the University of Wisconsin, Baraboo, Sauk City. Kelly, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as you mentioned, this is the second community-written novel that Baraboo residents have come together to create. Where did this idea of collaborative community writing come from?
Well, every year now for about 3 or 4 years, we've had Somerset Festival of the Arts, and it's all the arts, visual arts, performing arts, written arts, and we try and make it very integrated. So I was working on the literary committee of Somerset, and one of our other committee members saw an article in, I think it was American Libraries magazine, about another community that was doing a community novel, and we thought, oh, this would be great for our festival.
Well, tell us about Dr. Vertigo's Circus Spectacular. What's it about?
The general concept is a dying circus comes to a dying town. We didn't picture it as Baraboo. We pictured it as something maybe farther north, a little more isolated, a population of about 8,000. And we came up with the idea as a group last Somerset Festival of the Arts. So whoever came to that workshop really had input in deciding what this year's theme would be. And, of course, with our circus history here in Baraboo, people naturally thought about a traveling circus.
And how many writers have contributed to the novel?
Well, I teach creative writing, and that's part of the assignment we do over the course of the semester is to write a submission. And then we always get some from the community. So we have gotten a few more than we've been able to publish. But I think the first year was about 12, and I think the second year was maybe more like 15, 16.
And tell us a little bit about the range of writers. How experienced are they? Is there a range of experience?
Yes. We've had, let's see, I think one of the people who came up with the idea last time is a costume designer here in Baraboo, and she is retired working in Baraboo. And one of the other people who came up with the idea was one of my students who's about 30 years old. We've also had students, you know, as young as, well, really as young as high school can submit. I think the youngest we've taken is probably 18, 19, all the way through retired. And, of course, the range of experiences and vision is just delightful, you know, as a reader and a teacher.
I'm really curious about the process of putting the book together from its conception to the publication. And to start out, I mean, you talked about the bare bones details that you began with at the start of the story. How much information are the authors given before they take off and write their own chapter?
I think it varied from the 2 years we've done it. We did it two different ways. The first year in 2013, we did Eminent Domain. And the premise was that a two-lane highway was going to become a four-lane highway in this town to get to the big city. And any businesses, churches, schools, houses, farms that were in the way would be bulldozed down and given money by the government. In that one, my creative writing students, who included community members, because I always have adult community members take creative writing. We really tweaked the concept throughout the semester, so by the time we were done with the concept in about December, ready to have submissions, we had tweaked it so that we decided, well, every business or house or church or farm will have a secret that's either going to be revealed or buried with the house. And I'm not sure we would have come up with that right away. So that's something that evolved through discussion that made it more interesting. The second time this summer, it was really just that initial meeting, and we never saw that original group of community members who came together to come up with a concept. So we didn't really have the luxury of tweaking the idea. I think that gave people more freedom. But I also think it made the collection a little less cohesive than the first year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm curious about that. How do you achieve cohesion and even a clear story arc when so many people are working independently and taking the story maybe in competing directions?
Mm-hmm. Well, we cheated a little because the community that first did this that we read about, I think, did it sequentially. And they published a chapter online, and then the next writer wrote a chapter, read that chapter, wrote it, and published it online. And we decided that that would be a little tricky for us because we really wanted to get a range of submissions rather than dictate, okay, you write this chapter, and then you write the next chapter. We really wanted it to be really a community project, and everyone could submit. And the way the other community had done it was they had really had to choose writers to submit because it was done seriatim. So ours is, I guess, a little more of a collection in that there are different styles, not a linear plot, although when we edited it, my student Candace Wade and I, we tried to think of some sort of progression in terms of before the circus, during the circus, and after the circus.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you see as the benefits of a project like this?
I do think it brings the community together. You know, at the Somerset Festival, we have all these great bands. We had Sexy Esther come. We have great theatrical performances, and those seem to always get a lot of people involved. And, you know, as wordsmiths, maybe sometimes we feel we're not among the sexier of the integrated workshops at Somerset, but this really gave everyone an opportunity to contribute. Everyone comes to listen to the reading. We kick off Somerset with a community novel reading. I think it's a great sense of community where you're just not riding alone. You need to work with other people a little bit.
In our last few moments here, how can people read the book?
It's on our website at UW Baraboo, and I'll send a link to that. And I also just want to mention quickly, our ideas for next year are either, they will be more of a collection than a novel. We're either thinking of Baraboo Ghost Stories or Palm of the Hand Memoir. And I'll send a link to that workshop, which Baraboo does too. But we'd love to get the greater Baraboo Madison community involved in giving us ideas or letting us know what they think of those ideas.
Great.
Too.
And we will post that on our Facebook page. Kelly, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much.
That was Kelly Dwyer, Senior Lecturer of English and Creative Writing at UW-Baraboo, Sauk County.